My name is Daniel Scher. I'm the Associate Director of the Innovations for Successful Societies project, and I'm here with Director Rosa Retty of the Directorate on Corruption and Economic Crimes in Gaborone, Botswana. The date is the 22nd of July 2009. Ma'am, thank you very much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to meet with me. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Before we begin, I wonder if you would mind just introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about your career background and the position that you currently hold.
My name is Rose Sereza. I am currently acting as the director of the Directorate on Corruption and Economic Crime. I started working here for the DCEC in 1997. That was after I had worked for the local authorities for a period of about 6 years. My background qualification is a degree in construction engineering and management from Ferris State University in the US, after which I graduated and started working for the local authorities as a technical officer responsible for construction projects. That was in 1991. I moved to the Directorate on Corruption and Economic Crime in 1997, where I started working mainly at corruption prevention in the construction industry. My focus was really looking at ways of preventing corruption in the construction industry, in the civil engineering industry. And I later moved on to another division within the directorate, a division of public education, which was also to educate members of the public on evils of corruption and to solicit their support. I then moved with another division, which was mainly the Human Resource and Administration Division, where I was now responsible for the administrative aspect of the Directorate on Corruption, until I moved to another division of performance improvement or performance management system, where I was now coordinating the performance improvement activities of the Directorate on Corruption. I was then appointed the deputy director in 2007. A position which I held until the former director retired this year in April, and I began to hold the office of the director on an acting basis, which is currently what I'm doing now.
Okay, excellent. So when you joined the DCEC in 1997, it's my understanding it was established in
1994.
It
was established in 1994.
Okay, so it was still a fairly
new organization. Yes.
And I guess trying to really carve out its place within the political and social and economic sphere here.
Yes.
And I wonder if you can talk a bit about those early days, you know, what... you know, how you went about trying to build support for the types of activities that you were engaged in when the institution was still quite new and perhaps not so well known in the public's eyes.
Yes. At that time, the biggest challenge, like you say, was that the organization was still fairly new. Not many people knew about it, and it was only based in Gaborone. Mm-hmm. So it was really quite a challenge because we had to travel around the country educating people on first of all on the mandate of the directorate, and also on explaining to them what corruption and economic crime really meant and what they can do to help the DCEC fight the scourge. And in 1997, an office was established in Francistown, so that also helped a bit. Mm-hmm. Because it sort of now, you know, gave the DCC two areas of operation, one in Gaborone and one in Francistown. Although Botswana, as you would know, it's a very large country that really, you know, okay, provided some relief, but still it meant a lot of traveling, you know, it meant a lot of canvassing for support. And I must say that the directorate was well received by members of the public. Because at the time when it was formed in 1994, it was after government had started seeing some trends of corruption. There was a scandal involving Botswana Housing Corporation in the 1990s where tenders were awarded or bids were awarded corruptly. There was also a procurement of a primary school's consignment worth 91 million that also was awarded in a corrupt manner. There were some scandals involving the land, the allocation of land within Gaborone and the areas surrounding Gaborone. So that and a number of events that started unfolding, government began to realize that there was a need to establish a fully-fledged organization that mm-hmm. will deal with the problem of corruption. So it was well-received because people or even the nation had felt that, you know, that was the time to really establish such an organization. So the support from the onset was quite a good one.
I see. Now, a major problem in setting up commissions such as this one in many countries in the world is finding the right people to staff it.
Yes.
And obviously you came with a very appropriate background, coming from with a degree in construction management and then moving into corruption in the construction sector.
Yes.
So how did the DCEC go about finding people such as yourself and putting them into positions where they could really utilize their prior experience?
During the early days of the DCEC depended a lot on officers coming from the police service mm-hmm. on secondment. A good number of officers joined the DCEC on secondment from the Botswana Police, and they chose to stay after some time. They didn't go back. A few of them went back, but the majority stayed. There was also, as you might be aware or you may not be aware, the DCEC is modeled on the Independent Commission Against Corruption of Hong Kong. A number of expatriates who had previously served at the ICAC in Hong Kong joined the DCEC. At that particular point in time, we had about 14 expatriates who mainly worked for the Independent Commission Against Corruption. So that also came to boost the skills and the expertise. There was also a massive recruitment of graduates from the University of Botswana with various disciplines. The DCEC, as you have rightly said, composes of, you know, officers with several backgrounds. You have people in accounting, you have people who were teachers before, you have people who have lawyers, you know, we have all sorts of disciplines so as to cater for all the challenges that emerge when fighting corruption. So that's basically the setup of the human resources.
Now, Botswana is renowned around the world for its relatively low levels of corruption, especially when you look to some of the country's neighbors. Obviously, you had some major scandals which prompted the establishment of this organization, but I wonder if you could perhaps reflect on why you think Botswana hasn't succumbed to wide-scale corruption in the same way that many other countries in the region have.
I would say Botswana practices good governance, which I think is the cornerstone in terms of fighting corruption. You know, all the three arms of government operate very independently from one another. You have the executive, you have the legislature, and you have the judiciary, all independent from each other and maintaining checks and balances from one another. You also have the democratic setup. You know, you have a strong media, you know, that really keeps government on its checks, and you have everybody really playing their part in making sure that things are done in a transparent and open manner. And I think the one thing that really gives Botswana credit is the openness in which things are done, especially at government level. You get into a government department, you can even ask for services to get an explanation of how things are done, the procedures that have followed. You get a thorough explanation of that, and we see transparency and accountability as the key cornerstones. that really has kept Botswana, you know, at a very low level of corruption.
I see. Excellent. So one of the things that we've been looking at is public sector or civil service reform in countries around the world. And Botswana is quite interesting in that it has a very big public sector that's really driving a lot of the development and a lot of the activity. Now, traditionally, corruption can occur in the public sector because there are many avenues and many different things going on. And I was wondering if you have any particular activities focused on reducing the incidence of corruption or reducing the opportunity for corruption within the public service itself.
Yes. We have a division. There are three divisions within the DCC. One is the Investigations Division, the Public Education Division, and then the Corruption Prevention Division. The Corruption Prevention Division is the one that is particularly, you know, focusing on reducing corruption opportunities in government departments. What they do is they will go into a government department. Mm-hmm. After identifying the corruption-prone areas, they will go into a government department, they will study the systems, the procedures, the regulations, and the policies that operate in that government department to see if there aren't any opportunities for corruption. After doing that study, they will come up with a very detailed report, a report which they will submit to the management of the department, identifying where the corruption opportunities are, and even coming up with recommendations that spells out what can be done in order to close the loopholes or the corruption opportunities that would have been identified. A number of studies have been done, for instance, at the Department of Immigration and Citizenship, Department of Roads, Transport and Safety, Department of Building and Engineering Services, you know, such departments that we could call corruption-prone departments. You know, there are quite a number of studies that have been done and recommendations have been made. Right now, what we have started as a new concept is the Corruption Prevention Committees. Mm-hmm. The Corruption Prevention Committees aim at identifying people within a department and educating them on corruption prevention strategies and making those few people, maybe 7 or 8, to form a committee that will now look at corruption opportunities within that department and then even come up with some strategies themselves, because we believe that people who work at that department are better placed to see what is, you know, right or wrong, you know, better than even us, the DCC, who will be coming as outsiders. So the Corruption Prevention Committee started operating last year and we are beginning to see the fruits.
What was the thinking behind or the reasoning behind establishing these committees last year?
It was after we had realized that, okay, we are fighting corruption as a DCEC, but corruption is not one thing that can be fought by the DCEC alone. The involvement of the different ministries and departments are very critical, mm-hmm. and the ownership of the accounting officers within those departments and ministries are very critical in terms of fighting corruption. That is why we decided to come up with a concept of Corruption Prevention Committee. We had also seen it working very well in Tanzania and Kenya.
I see. And just on this, the previous thing you mentioned about your office is undertaking reviews of the ministries and identifying corruption-prone areas. Mm-hmm. How regularly do these take place?
Quite regularly. Yeah. Like in a year, for instance, it's only that the division itself is hampered by a shortage of manpower. But in a year, they will do about 3 departments.
Okay, I see. And then they make recommendations. And
yes.
Do you have any authority to compel ministries to accept these recommendations or to implement them?
Yes, the Corruption and Economic Crime Act actually states that we can instruct the department to implement our recommendations. We haven't really gone to the point of instructing because we always do it on a more cordial basis.
Sure.
Yes, and we haven't really met too much resistance. There has been some resistance here and there, but not mm-hmm. to the extent that we had to instruct.
So you must have quite good working relationships with the ministry.
Yes, we have established good working relationship with the heads of the departments and ministries.
And this is something that many countries struggle with. I mean, how have you gone about cultivating this type of supportive relationship so that you're not seen as sort of coming in and making demands and scrutinizing what's going on, but rather as a partner in making the ministry more efficient mm-hmm. in what it does?
Yeah. Through collaboration, such as through meetings, we have sat together and, you know, really talked about the need to work together to fight mm-hmm. the scourge. And the permanent secretaries, who are the heads of the ministries, actually see the need right. for them to also fight corruption. And through that, it has, you know, become, and also with this performance management system, because performance management system is all encompassing. It's even mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. how is your ministry, is your performance in all issues, including in areas of fighting corruption. No head of an organization would want their ministry to be labeled as the most corrupt mm-hmm. ministry. So every head is taking responsibility, because they don't want to be seen to be called the most corrupt ministry or the most corrupt department.
Do you actually make rankings or
we have a pie chart which tables the ministries according to the percentages to say which ministry is leading in terms of the number of investigations that we have launched.
Oh, really?
For instance, at the moment, the Ministry of Local Government is at is the highest at 29% in terms of the number of investigations that we've launched in that ministry. And it's because of the nature of the ministry. It's a very big ministry. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of social services. Mm-hmm. It encompasses local authorities, and local authorities is where really the problem is.
Mm. And spread out across the country?
Yes,
also.
It spreads out across the country.
I see. So one of the things that I'm sort of wondering, so obviously Botswana has relatively low levels mm-hmm. of corruption compared to other places. How does this affect your work? And that's a lot of the people I've spoken to say, oh, you know, our corruption's not a problem here. You know, we don't really have those sorts of problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have any problem in making yourself or making people aware that what you're doing is exceptionally relevant, and that the minute you start relaxing on these sorts of things, that's when it's going to really grow?
In fact, a lot of people now, I don't know whether it's because of the economic recession or what, but a lot of members of the public feel that corruption is all over the place. I mean, we even get calls that say, you know, we are just sitting there, there's corruption all over the place. The perception has gone up, it's very high. People just think that, you know, wherever you go, you are stepping on corruption, and especially in the procurement and bidding process. So, you know, it's really keeping us on our toes, because we get a lot of reports. Okay, some of the reports are anonymous, and anonymous reports make it very difficult to follow, but in any case, we allow for anonymous reports. Some reports do have a lot of substance, and, you know, they're taken before the court of law. But in terms of the perception of corruption is quite high.
Mm-hmm. So occasionally you must have to make decisions that could have political repercussions or could offend people in high places. How do you instruct your officers to deal with perhaps unhappy politicians or unhappy government officials who are not pleased with the way things are going, or the way decisions have been made that may adversely affect them or implicate them?
The one fortunate thing for now is that we haven't really had any problems of, you know, anyone thinking that we have stepped on their toe, or anyone thinking that we have made decisions that are, you know, contra their interest or anything. We've been operating very freely and without any fear or victimization or anything like that. So that has really worked for us. I don't know if in future anything of that nature will come, but, you know, one just believes that the situation will stay as it is, where we are allowed to operate professionally and because we also do our work in a very professional manner. We don't just, you know, take somebody to or investigate someone just because we are told that they are corrupt or anything. We do our own preliminary investigations and to see whether what we are doing is the right thing or not.
I see. So in many other countries, this type of work is extremely dangerous.
Yes.
And I'm sure here, even though to a lesser extent, your office are still engaged in work that could be risky. Mm. Do you take any particular steps or provide any particular advice to them to ensure their own safety?
Yes, we do. We tell them to behave in a very professional manner. Not to go around, you know, even after hours bragging about working for the DCEC and thinking that it's something to be proud and to brag about, you know, to conduct themselves in a, we emphasize on discipline, that they should, you know, conduct themselves in a highly disciplined manner. Because sometimes people expose themselves in the manner, by the manner in which they behave. Yeah, but so far, there hasn't been any threat.
You mentioned a few countries that you've imported ideas and models from. Firstly, Hong Kong, the ICAC, and you also mentioned Kenya and Tanzania. And I was wondering, what are the forums that you go to look for new ideas and get fresh information about the types of initiatives that other countries are undertaking?
Okay, we attend the International Anti-Corruption Conferences. We attend the Global Forum on Corruption, and even the regional forums on corruption. We also do our own benchmarking exercises, where officers just leave here to visit a country to go and see how that country operates.
It's interesting that you mentioned the ICAC model that the DCEC was based off, because it's my understanding that many other countries around the same time, sort of mid to late 90s, tried to also replicate the ICAC model. I know Zambia tried, Malawi tried, Kenya tried in the same time period, and yet those didn't fare quite as well as the DCEC has, and their reputations for integrity and actually making a difference were never quite established. And I wonder if you're sort of familiar with these cases and having been involved in the early days at that time, whether you can comment on what really made the DCEC a success, where other countries that were trying to do similar things based on similar models, presumably with quite similar information, were not able to achieve the same level of success.
I think the DCEC success has been really on political will. Because it's one thing to set up an anti-corruption agency. It's another thing to be committed to it. And what I see from my own readings and my own observation is that some countries just set up anti-corruption agencies as a window dressing mechanism, maybe because of the structural adjustment programs and, you know, to be seen to be doing something, but not that really they were committed to what they said they were doing. But with the DCEC, there has been a lot of political will, and I think that has really kept us going.
I see. So you don't, I mean, you are confident of the backing of the highest levels of government and all the work that you undertake?
Yes, we are. In fact, the some of the initiatives that are being implemented by ministries and government departments come from the president himself.
I see.
Through the president's initiatives.
So there really is no substitute for good firm leadership from the top and support.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. One thing that I'm particularly interested in and that I've heard quite a lot about is the introduction of performance management systems. Firstly, in the various ministries of the public service itself, I'd like to, if we may, just talk a little bit about that, because I understand that a lot of these performance management systems can actually be viewed as anti-corruption systems in terms of incentivizing productivity and de-incentivizing the inefficiency that corruption brings. I wonder if you have any particular thoughts on that, or whether you have had sort of any involvement or input into the implementation of these systems.
Yeah, I strongly believe that, and it's something that we have seen here, that performance management system, when it's up and running and being implemented fully, it is an anti-corruption strategy. Because in performance management system, the emphasis is on improving the systems, is on, you know, tightening controls, making sure that people are accountable for their deeds, you know, making sure that things are done in a transparent manner, making sure that things are done in the most effective and efficient way. And all these, they are ingredients for anti-corruption, you know, accountability, control, internal controls, you know, putting measures in place that shows effectiveness and efficiency, which are all part of the performance management system. So in Botswana, we've realized that the combination of the performance management system, where even people are praised for their performance, is a good ingredient for fighting corruption.
And within the DCEC, you have implemented your, I mean, the same performance management system that has been put into place.
Rolled out to government, yes.
Would you mind talking a little bit about that, about how that has been implemented here?
We produced a strategic plan. We came up with a strategy map for the DCEC. We produced a balanced scorecard. We have periodic reviews on a quarterly basis, performance reviews on a quarterly basis, where we each present our review reports, and then we have the performance appraisals on a quarterly basis, where officers are appraised for their performance, and that is something that is done throughout the entire public service.
Now, obviously, as somebody who is very immersed in anti-corruption activities, you're very familiar with this idea that corruption is very difficult to define. And there's some very straightforward cases of corruption, but there's also things that are a little more difficult.
Gray areas.
And also things that are perhaps more difficult to identify, things like, say, nepotism. And I wonder how you go about trying to combat those sorts of corruption, say somebody hiring his friend or his relative, or should I stop?
No, just go ahead. In fact, have you seen our Corruption and Economic Crime Act?
I haven't taken a close look at it. No.
Oh, okay. I'll find a copy for you.
Excellent. Yeah.
But in terms of the Corruption and Economic Crime Act, yes, you are right, corruption is very difficult to define. It is just defined by way of giving examples in Section 23. But things like conflict of interest, we do investigate and even, you know, prosecute for. If I sit in a recruitment board where my sister is going to be interviewed and even offered employment as the DCC, and I don't declare my interests, it's something that I can be prosecuted for, because that is conflict of interest. There are certain areas where we find that this is purely maladministration. It's not corruption. In those cases, we really, what we do is we refer them back to the departments to say, we have received such and such a report, but according to us, we realize that this is a matter that can be better dealt administratively by your department. Please investigate and give us feedback.
Okay.
And departments have done that, you know, most of the time on issues of promotions, issues of, you know, people complaining about unfair transfers and things like that.
It's my understanding that in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a very big decentralization process from the DPSM to all the other ministries, so that a lot of the previously centralized control, controlled hiring and recruitment procedures were now spread out amongst all the ministries. I wonder if that process made your job, at least as regards these sort of conflicts of interest and nepotism issues, more difficult, because now instead of, you know, a centralized board, you have recruitment and promotion boards in all of the ministries.
Yeah, the reports increased actually.
Yeah.
The reports increased, especially of unfair hiring practices, nepotism, favoritism. And I should say that I'm not sure if you know about the Ombudsman.
I do know.
Yeah, the Office of the Ombudsman really handles those. They are mandated to handle those. So some of them, when they come here, we refer them to the Ombudsman. Some of the reports, when the Ombudsman receives them, he refers them to us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. Did you take the increase in the number of reports as an indication of an increase in the number of incidences, or an indication of the increased, perhaps, transparency of the process, in which it was sort of easier to identify possible conflicts of interest when there were many different boards as opposed to just one?
I think it was in incidences, because, you know, African countries, Botswana included, the rate of employment is quite, still quite, you know, unemployment is still on the high side. Mm-hmm. Okay, not high compared to other countries. But obviously we are still facing challenges of unemployment. And, you know, if you read some of the reports, you can see that this was a situation where an aunt was trying to employ a niece, or, you know, an uncle was trying to employ a nephew, or a friend was trying to employ a friend, you know, mainly not because they wanted anything in return, a bribe or anything.
Yeah.
Just that, you know, my niece is not working and I have to find employment for her. And since now I'm the employing authority, I can be able to do that. I mean, these are the type of reports that we see, and I think it was just the opportunity that presented itself.
I see. Was there an initial spike and then things leveled out?
Then things leveled up, yes.
Initially,
when it started, it was a bit high, but with time, it sort of just normalized.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
One of the things I was wondering is, you obviously have a lot of resources at your disposal and personnel, although you did mention there are some manpower shortages. I wonder, what are the types of things you feel you could use or would need to be able to do your job even more effectively? Is it, you know, more resources, more authority, basically more manpower? What are the types of things that would make your job easier?
Yeah, authority, we don't have a problem with authority because our act is very clear. The human resources are always a challenge. You know, manpower, I mean, we operate on a budget, and obviously, like any other government department, you can never say the budget is enough. You wish you could have more, but then you learn to do within your means. Yeah. But I'm happy because we, through the new National Development Plan, we're in the process of expanding both in terms of offices and also in terms of the number of people.
I see. Are there any particular cost-saving measures that you have adopted or that have worked particularly well in terms of perhaps expanding your influence or expanding your reach at a relatively low cost?
The only one that I can think of is just the, you know, encouraging our officers not to, because when you go on a trip, obviously you spend a night in a hotel.
Yeah.
What we have come up with internally is that we have encouraged our officers to book in cheaper hotels. It's a way of, you know, minimizing on the cost.
Yeah.
And also to combine trips. If an officer has a trip in Francistown, you know, he should look around for people who are also going to Francistown so that they make one joint trip, rather than having, you know, four or five vehicles following one another to Francistown.
I see. One thing that I've noticed in a few areas, advertisements for the DCEC saying you can call this number or you can email this address, the report to DCEC email address with any tips or whistleblowing type activities. In some countries, this becomes quite a problem because when you open up these sorts of avenues to the public, they can sometimes be abused with a lot of false claims being laid and sort of unverifiable things that can take up officers' times. How do you, what has your experience been of opening up these avenues for public communication?
Is there in anonymous reports where we find ourselves sometimes having to run around, you know, chasing a wild goose? But it's only so far as anonymous reports are concerned. But anonymous reports then are lower compared to reports where people identify themselves. But those are the instances where sometimes we, you know, go around trying to investigate. In the end, we realize that we're not heading anywhere, and then we close the investigation. But we would have started the process. But it's mostly in anonymous reports.
Okay, I see. And in terms of reaching out to people in the rural communities, what types of public education campaigns or activities are you engaged in outside of the capital and perhaps Francistown?
I don't know if you are familiar with the concept of Kotla meeting.
I am.
The public education conducts Kotla meetings accompanied by members. When a member of parliament is going to his constituency to talk about government projects, then they will normally send their schedule, and the public education officer will be there. We also have the radio programs, we have the television programs, we have publications that we send out to the districts.
So it's very comprehensive.
It is. We also have youth programs spread across the country.
When you look back at your career here, and you've obviously been involved at various levels, what do you consider your biggest success to have been, or the thing that you're perhaps most proud of having accomplished?
The thing that I'm most proud of is the performance management, because the strategic plan of the DCEC, I pioneered it. You know, it was during the time when I was a performance improvement coordinator, and I also saw to its implementation. And during the time when the performance management system was being introduced in government, there were a lot of initiatives. You know, we had to revise some of our operations. We had to come up with some of the conditions of service, you know, develop some the, you know, things that determined our salaries and so forth. And I was always, you know, involved at the forefront of those processes.
Sorry, I missed the point at which you were a performance improvement coordinator. Was that within the DCEC?
Yes, within the DCEC.
Itself? Oh, okay,
yeah.
I see.
When performance management started, I was the performance improvement coordinator.
But you were already working at the DCEC?
Yes,
so you
I was just moving from one unit to the other.
Oh, okay, okay. I'm very interested in these positions because they sound to be quite difficult, the performance improvement coordinators. And in that you're the point person within the unit.
Of the performance of the organization.
So can and it certainly sounds to me that the performance management system, while extremely laudable and having very good effects, must have been quite difficult for the people who were expected to adopt it, in that instead of sort of doing things as they had always done them, they now have targets and goals and are expected to achieve a much higher level of productivity. So how did you go about selling that idea to the people within the DCEC?
Well, it was tough.
Yeah.
Very tough, I must say, because it was a new concept. People were not used to change. I mean, when somebody has been doing something for the past 10 years, and you come up and say, no, you need to change this thing and do it this way. It wasn't easy.
Yeah.
So, you know, at first it was a bit frustrating. But I began to take units in smaller, or officers in smaller groups,
mm-hmm.
to get their buy-in of every process. Yeah. Before I brought them in a larger group, I would first start small, you know, because you can't really convince people in a multitude, as opposed to when you take them in bits and pieces. So that's how I managed. By the time I would call a big gathering, I would have already solicited support within the small units.
I see.
And also I used to call, because each ministry had its own performance improvement coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
I would bring in the performance improvement coordinators from other ministries. And I'll go to, because they were facing the same problem that I was facing, I'll move here and go and speak at another ministry to convince those ones. So as the performance improvement coordinators of that time, because we were the very, very first batch, we worked very closely to one another. And that really helped us.
Sure. Mm. So were you part of the original batch that were trained in Singapore?
Yeah, we were the first batch. No, I didn't go to... I went to the U.S., Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
There's a performance center there. Okay. Yeah, so we were trained there for about 2 weeks.
Yeah. And then, and your idea behind calling in your colleagues from other ministries and going there was to emphasize that it was a
national thing, yes.
Yeah. Mm. And was that quite successful?
It was very successful, very.
So it wasn't just sort of...
Because sometimes your people, they really take you for granted.
Yeah.
But when you go out or you bring someone else, they tend to listen to that person more than you.
I see.
Yeah.
It certainly sounds like a very difficult position to be in, because on the one hand, you're within the organization,
mm-hmm.
but you're sort of a little bit apart from it.
Yeah, that's why even the reporting structure... Like right now, my position here is the position of a permanent secretary, which is at ministry level.
Right.
So as a performance improvement coordinator, you don't report to the people in between. You report straight to the men on top.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is how you become detached from the rest of the hierarchy, because you are expected to be there leading the organization.
Yes. Yeah. And yes, at the same time, it sounds like a very innovative and sort of necessary role.
Yeah.
Because you can imagine without having a point person within the ministry, it would be very difficult to unroll these complicated systems.
It will be,
So were you able to see should I stop?
Okay.
Yeah. Be helpful, that's very interesting.
No, it's very,
it's very interesting. Okay, let me see. This is part two of the interview with Director Rose Soretti. We were just talking about the performance improvement coordinators being located sort of outside and reporting directly to the permanent secretaries, but sort of trying to imagine how you would try and implement a system without this person, and how the performance improvement coordinators were really the linchpins for rolling out the
PMS. The performance improvement coordinators. Really a person within the organization, but like I said, reporting straight to the highest man on top or the mm-hmm. highest woman on top. He didn't have to go through the hierarchy of reporting like with other officers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he was reporting direct and in charge of all the units or all the departments within
mm-hmm.
the organization.
How did you get to be in that position? Did you put yourself forward as that, or were you selected?
No, I was just appointed.
Okay. Mm. Okay. Sure. It sounds like a very tough job.
It is.
But what I was going to ask, you said that this was your biggest success, and I wonder if you consider it a success because you saw actual improvements in the way that people were doing things.
Yes. I saw a lot of improvement. I saw a lot of turnaround. Even in the manner in which, you know, services, we are now taking services to the people, and the manner in which now officers were even conducting themselves, and even in achieving some of the things that we had asked from other government departments.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I see. And has it been difficult to sustain that level of productivity and turnaround?
No, not really. It hasn't been. It sort of remained the same, or if not improved.
Is that because of the inbuilt system of reviews and
yes,
targets?
Yes, it's because of the reviews and targets.
So there's no real opportunity for standards to slide or.
No, there is a problem though with some people dragging for, you know. The first problem is that people don't review on time. They will always come up with excuses. Secondly, even those who review, sometimes they are not honest. They'll give someone a 95% or a 90%. When it comes to the time of promotion, they will tell you that this officer is not performing. Now, when you look at the performance appraisal form, you see that the person was given 90%. So this, you know, is the inconsistency in the reviewing process that has proved to be a challenge.
I see. But otherwise it's
a very good system, and it has worked well for us.
Excellent. Well, I'm conscious of the various demands on your time, and I was just wondering if I could ask as a sort of wrap-up question, what advice you would give to your colleagues in similar situations in countries around the world. What is it important for a director to know, and a director of an agency such as this? What are the ways in which he or she should act to really lead an organization to combat the scourge of corruption?
What I'll say is that the director of an agency such as this should always be on top of issues. You know, within the divisions of the organization, you have to know what is happening. You know, it's like your pulse should be on every division within the organization to see what is going on, and, you know, to sort of always have a plan ahead, because corruption unfolds every day. Different patterns. Nowadays we have money laundering, we have cyber crime, you know, we have organized crime, and you should always be planning ahead, because criminals themselves are always, you know, one step ahead. If we are planning this side, they are also planning on the other side. So it's very important that you don't let your programs to remain stagnant. They should always be reviewed periodically, and make sure that you are keeping up with the pace, such that, you know, you are not caught off guard.
Excellent. And maybe one very final last question.
Okay.
Future challenges. What do you see the major challenges that your organization is facing as it moves forward? And I promise this is my last question, and then I'll wrap up.
The future challenge that I see is that corruption is taking a different shape on a day-to-day basis. You know, corruption is no longer the type where I would come and say to you, give me 50 pula and you'll get a passport, or if you do this for me in 3 days, this is how much I'll give you. No. It has become more complicated, to the point that sometimes, you know, the evidence is very difficult, and that is why it needs new strategies all the time. Because the paper trail also becomes very, you will see that, you know, on paperwork it looks like something was done above board perfectly, and yet, you know, a lot has gone wrong. So one needs to be strategizing on a daily basis. And I see the challenge of money laundering becoming a more serious challenge in future because of this, you know, computerized globalization and so forth, where you can transmit money in a matter of seconds to the other side of the world.
Excellent.
Well, one last question.
No. I won't.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been a very helpful interview for the work that I'm doing, and I really appreciate it.
Okay.